Hey, it's Bob Johnson here. How are you? We're live here on Blog Talk Radio. We also do a program called Second Saturday Magazine. My first guest is coming right up. He is the author of a new book. It's called Pope Annalisa, and it's book one in the First Souls trilogy. Peter Cavanaugh, are you on the phone with me?
Yes. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Hi, how are you? I'm good. I'm sorry to hear about your situation. I know you're on the road. We were expecting a nice, clean landline, but, you know, these are the way things go.
Yes, I'm sorry to have to call you from a cell phone today. I had a little bit of a family emergency. Apologize about that.
Okay, no problem. I just want to give you a little bit of an intro, and then we'll talk about the book. And hopefully joining me in just a few minutes is my co-host Meredith Kagan. And she's also, she hasn't read the book, but she's done a lot of research into the background, the origins of the church. Anyway, it's called Pope Annalisa, and it's a story of a pope who happens to be African from Nigerian. And another unusual thing, she is a woman. And it is the intrigue, the behind-the-scenes look at the Vatican, and some other intrigues, oil, geopolitical oil, economy. Also, too, it's written in 2025. And, Peter, is this your first attempt at writing a novel?
Yeah, it actually was, Bob. I had the idea for this book really probably about 10 or 12 years ago when I was in a screenwriting class, and they kind of challenged us to come up with an idea that nobody's really ever done before. And being spiritually oriented, I started a sort of train of thought, well, what haven't we seen? We haven't seen a female priest and certainly not a female pope. And I kind of just cued off of that idea and said, okay, well, what would the church be like? What would the world be like that would be able to, you know, such an event would be able to happen when, you know, the church, of course, has been dominated by males for 2,000 years. So it sort of progressed from that point.
Yeah, you have this cast of characters in this very complex, well-constructed novel. It really draws you in. We have what appear to be miracles by this nun. We have the history of the church and the cosmic war between Christianity and Islam, and also the cosmic war that exists in the Catholic Church itself, right here in the book. How do you bring all these things together?
Yeah, there's a lot of conflict in the book, and it does happen at multiple levels, as you pointed out. A couple things. The essence of the book is a spiritual message, but, you know, I really wanted to craft a book that would be a very interesting read because it wasn't meant to be preachy, and I didn't want to come off like a soapbox preacher on a corner, because that's the surest way to kill a novel, and after all, it is a fictional novel. So the first priority of any fictional work is it's got to be readable and it has to be interesting. So the setting is an international setting, and it's not a Catholic book, I might point out. The church is basically a vehicle to tell a universal story that is applicable to all of humanity, and it's even applicable at higher levels. It's a story about, you know, good and evil, light and shadow, and the fact that they're not always that distinguishable sometimes. Throughout much of the story, many people question this female pope and whether, you know, she is the cause of all the troubles that are happening in the world, or whether she's going to be sort of a savior figure. So through much of the book, I think the reader will be asking themselves those kinds of questions. And it does happen at many different levels. But I think ultimately, if you really dig down deep into the book, it's really a message about the origin, destiny, and purpose of humanity, where we came from, why we're here, what our true reality is like, and what is our purpose in this world.
Yeah, and you set up these conflicts that are, even though you set it in 2025, these conflicts are here now. And one of the quotes in the book that struck me and reminded me a little bit of Nietzsche: evil is simply error. And Nietzsche, I think, said, there's no such thing as evil. It's just one person, and I'm paraphrasing, one person's ideas of good being acted out. So yeah, this exploration of evil versus good is always fascinating to humanity, isn't it?
Well, I think that, you know, as human beings, we're creatures of light and shadow, and that goes according to different degrees. And if you want, and to take a spiritual explanation from the ancient wisdom tradition that we explore in the book, the concept of the Gnostics and the ancient wisdom tradition is that everything proceeds from consciousness. Now, you can call that consciousness God, you can call it higher intelligence, give any name you're comfortable to, but it is a higher intelligence. And that this intelligence, this divine intelligence, essentially spread itself out into different points of view in order to maybe reflect upon itself, so that one consciousness with a capital C became many points of consciousness with a small C, which you could call ourselves. But at each level that consciousness emanated, or each level consciousness expressed itself, it was a little bit further and further from the center. And as a result,
I'm
sorry.
I guess we're getting a caller here. Hello.
I'm sorry, Peter. I just brought in Meredith Kagan. My fault. These bells and whistles on the Blog Talk Radio can get a little tricky.
Okay, no problem.
I apologize to you. Yes, you use the church, as you mentioned before. You used it as a metaphor for our, you know, struggles as human beings as we head toward the precipice, which is our, you know, we are, you know, we do have a sense of finality. I mean, we are going someplace. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, one of the quotes that you struck me was a quote from one of the popes that you put in the, you know, one of your character, Clement. Says people will turn to cults or violent aberrations of established religions. We are facing a moral and spiritual bankruptcy that can lead to corruption and dissolution, to error, and even to a form of neo-barbarism. Is it your thinking then that faith can still play a role in our society, or is faith on its way out, or where is faith? How does faith fit in with the survival of humanity? That's my question.
Yeah, I think it's a very good question, and let me give it a little bit of a detailed explanation. One of the things that I think the book points out is that we are caught in a polarized world today. Materialist science, which is pretty much atheistic, has so eroded the foundations of traditional religion that it's driven Christianity and other religions back into forms of fundamentalism or even extremism. I think Islamic fundamentalism is an expression of people's traditional beliefs being attacked and going to an extreme. But we even see it in this country. We have our own form of fundamentalism in this country. And much of it is a result of the attacks of science on the foundations of Christian faith and the faith of other religions. Now, the interesting thing about it is, and here's the beautiful message of the book. You know, there's a middle ground between the science on one hand and the literal fundamental religion on the other hand. Many people are kind of caught in a gray area where, you know, they no longer can believe in religion, but they feel the emptiness that materialist science brings. And so there's a lot of confused people out there. And the book presents a third way, and the third way is the recovery of this ancient spiritual tradition, which in the Western world took the form of Gnostic Christianity, merged with the findings that that are coming along in quantum physics. And the two of these currents that are coming from completely different streams of life are all pointing to the same thing. They're pointing to the fact that there is a consciousness out there that is the ground or the template for all of reality. There is a higher intelligence out there, and we are part of that matrix, let's say, or part of that network. And by understanding that, as opposed to materialist science, which says, no, there's no such thing as a higher intelligence, there's no such thing as higher energies, it all started from particles colliding with one another, and those particles eventually built themselves up to human beings and human brains, and everything can be explained from this materialist point of view. But quantum physics has turned that upside down and said materialist science is wrong, that it's actually consciousness that it comes first, and consciousness then goes ahead and, you know, through various processes, everything else in the world of appearances, you know, forms. So there's a bridge that is now happening between the ancient spiritual traditions and quantum physics that's pushing aside materialist science and even traditionalist religions and pointing to a new way and a new concept of understanding ourselves. So that third way is what's presented in the book. And yes, faith can still play a role in that, absolutely, because faith is a good starting point, Bob. If we have a lot of things that we don't completely understand around us because we dwell in the world of appearance, there are unseen energies around us, and sometimes to get into that world, you have to start off with a proposition of faith. But if you really keep up at it and you really have a desire to go beyond that, eventually everybody has the ability to contact this divine intelligence. And once people make that contact, they graduate from faith to knowledge, because knowledge derives from experience. Once you've experienced something, it's yours and you own it.
Well, I find this study of action at a distance, Einstein's, you know, look at how particles can affect each other, this mirror spindle neuron now that scientists are talking about, how we are connected consciously to other mammals like whales and dogs, elephants have this consciousness. There is now more and more scientific evidence pointing to this organized consciousness, and we're all connected. And these are the things that, have been looked at and have been studied by the great philosophers. And you talk about Jung, as a matter of fact, has a major influence on this connectedness, consciousness that we're all connected. And why do cultures have similar, have similar conscious figures, you know, that are
archetypes.
Archetypes. That's the word I was looking for. Why do we have all these archetypes, with all our cultures? So we're all connected.
Yes, and there's a pattern, and the forces that form archetypes are universal forces, and they express in all human beings, in all cultures, and all religions, because they're part of a pre-existing pattern, in effect, that is reflected in the material world, and it crops up in different ways, very often in myths, sometimes in religion or whatnot. And Jung, as you mentioned, who really was active primarily in the 1930s and 1940s, was astonished when they recovered the Gnostic Gospels. And he saw what the Gnostics were saying was exactly what his theories of depth psychology were saying, but it was 2,000 or 3,000 years earlier. And Jung's famous comment was, I found a home, when he first read the Gnostic Gospels.
Yeah, he wrote a lot about, and many of his writings are this free flow of consciousness too. So there's a lot of the Jungian feeling in your book too. Not in your book directly. I mean, we have a thriller here, nuts and bolts thriller. We have terrorist attacks. We have the tensions between the superpowers. We have the tensions between the Iran government versus Western world. So we have all those tensions in the book. But underneath it, we have our first female cardinal, who becomes Pope, Annalisa, and she's somewhat above.
Peter, what do you want readers? What do you want readers to take away when they're finished with your book? I mean, what hypotheses do you throw out in your book that you want somebody to walk away with saying, that could happen, or what do you want them to take away with themselves?
Yeah, I think two things: hope and knowledge. Hope in the fact that, as I was talking about this third way, which is the bridge between fundamentalist religion on one hand and traditional old-fashioned materialist science on the other hand, that this third way presents a very viable vision that is both in keeping with ancient spirituality and the most cutting-edge science in quantum physics, and that the realizations that one can understand in reading the book will really start to bring forth from our subconscious the awareness of spirituality within us and give it a concrete foundation so that people can see it in the form of a book and lives of the characters and say, you know what? Gosh, I knew that in the back of my mind. And I believe I have a better sense that I can get contact to higher intelligence. And that would lead to the second. Yeah.
you know, Freud talked about his goal of therapy was to make the unconscious part of us conscious, so
that's
that we're aware, we have complete and total self-awareness. Of course, I went to a behavioral school, which didn't really give Freud much credit. But how do you incorporate, you know, you seem to be incorporating that with the, I've never heard the phrase before, materialistic science.
I have.
You have, I haven't. It's sort of like
continuous
consumption.
Yeah, materialism is basically, you know, we have the nuts and bolts world of Newton, you know, who said that, you know, trucks will move at certain speeds and large bodies, planets, you know, have mass and gravitational attraction to the invisible connections between particles that are, you know, elusive, that, you know, are small, that there's no such thing as electrons. It's something has to be waving, though, and
Bob is correct. What the materialist science is essentially this, in a nutshell. Materialist science is the science that has developed over the past few centuries that essentially has come to the belief that everything starts from matter, that you start from elementary particles that collide with one another, and that somehow, in a way that they've never really explained satisfactorily, somehow that leads upward to the human being and life as we know it, and so forth. And the three pillars of materialist science have been traditional classical physics from Newton. In philosophy, it's Descartes' dualism, mind-body dualism, that the mind and the matter are separate things, and they're in separate realms. And the third one is Darwin, who expressed it in biological terms of evolution. And these are all offshoots. These are all offshoots of materialist science, because they proceed from physical observation. So because they proceed from physical observation, they naturally come to the conclusion that everything can be explained from natural material processes. But all of a sudden, you have quantum physics coming along, and quantum physics is probably the closest thing in science you have to metaphysics, because what they have discovered in the quantum physical world is that, number one, there is no such thing as matter. As Bob was saying, electrons are not really particles, or they don't start off as particles. They start off as waves of possibility that are smeared out across space, and they only collapse into observable reality when being observed by a conscious observer. And a whole bunch of other things would happen in quantum physical world. You would have electrons that are separated by vast distances, and yet they instantly communicate and react with one another no matter what the distance. Einstein called this feature, it's called in quantum physics non-locality, because it's a non-local energy that causes it. Einstein calls it spooky. So how do you explain from classical physics all these occurrences? Well, they can't do it. So they basically have said the only thing that accounts for the behavior in the quantum physical world, which gives rise to the world that we see, is if we understand that consciousness is the basis of everything. Consciousness comes first, and then all these other things we're talking about, possibility, matter, everything, comes as a result of the acts of consciousness.
In The Lost Symbol by Dan Brown, that was some of the backdrop. You remember she was working, trying to harness the energy of a collective consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So
I haven't had a chance to read that book by Dan yet, but you know, some things in
Dan's work.
It's very consistent
in what you're talking about right now.
Okay.
I just want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Peter Canova. He's the author of Pope Annalisa, and it's the first book in the trilogy. Have you the other two books outlined or written yet, or what's going on with the other two books?
Yeah, well, book two, which is called The 13th Disciple, and The 13th Disciple is Mary Magdalene, who plays a role in the first book, although not a prominent role, but she's very evident in sort of in the background of the first book. The 13th Disciple actually takes place partly during biblical times and partly as a continuation of the time period in Pope Annalisa with some of the remaining characters of the first book involved in that, and it cuts back and forth between you know, that modern time period and ancient times. And I've got that done in a draft form, but it's going to need a lot of work, so I imagine, you know, if the marketing of the first book ever gives me any time to breathe again, you know, maybe over the course of the next year, I'll be trying to, you know, put the finishing touches on book two.
And your book swept the Nautilus Awards. It won, you know, multiple awards from Nautilus. So you have, for a first novel, did that surprise you?
Well, yeah, actually, it won 3 medals from the Nautilus Awards, and then it also won a separate award called the Independent Publishers Award. I'm waiting to hear on 2 other book contest competitions that it was entered in, but those won't be announced until the fall. Yeah, it did come as a surprise to me because, you know, being a writer is a weird process, especially a new writer. When you first sit down, you take pen in hand, you have no idea whether you're writing something that anybody else but yourself can relate to. And there's nobody standing over your shoulder mentoring you saying, oh, yeah, that's good, cut that out, no, leave that, that'll work, that won't. It's a real process that you have to grope your way towards. So right up until the time that you really start to get that book out there in the market, it's a gradual process of revelation where you become aware, you know, if people can relate to your book or not. And I was certainly starting to get feedback that almost everybody that picked up the book liked it. But, yeah, it did come as somewhat of a surprise, you know, winning those 2 awards so quickly because those are the first 2 awards I ever entered with a book.
And you work with an editor, I take it?
Well, I actually worked with a couple of editors. And, you know, what you find, again, is the editors are so different. You'll get completely differing opinions from different editors. And at the end of the day, you really have to take the bull by the horns and make your own decisions. And I think that there were very few things that I changed structurally in the book as a result of working with the editors. I think the editors might have helped clarify certain passages that may not have been clear and so forth. But at the end of the day, the basic structure of the book, as you see, it was pretty much intact for, I'd say over the last couple of years prior to publication.
Yeah, I recommend this book to anyone who likes a good thriller. It has all of the kind of characters that you would expect, and it has a lot of surprising twists and turns. So it was a real good read. And, and again, the spirituality and the metaphysical stuff is all in there too. And just very entertaining, and it's a kind of book that you go away from and you think about.
Well, thank you. I think there's a little something in there for everybody because,
yeah,
you know, this action does happen at multiple levels. I mean, you have a struggle going on, you know, in the political, religious, spiritual, and you know, even in dimensions beyond. You have a parallel struggle going on throughout the book. And the focal point of all these struggles is the female Pope, is Pope Annalisa. And she's a pretty enigmatic character. And like I say, I think she doesn't come off as a goody-two-shoes right off the bat. It's not that kind of book. There's a real gray area about her throughout most of the book. And, you know, then maybe towards the end you'll start to draw some conclusions about her real nature and what she's all about. But she'll keep you wondering for a long time.
Yeah, you're thinking Mother Teresa, not quite.
Not quite, no.
Well, listen, thank you so much, Peter, for speaking with me today. As I said, the book is a real pleasure, and good luck with the book tour and all that, and good luck with the future contests. And
well,
I'm looking forward to book 2.
Thank you. I appreciate being on your show. Sorry I had a little emergency here, and we had to do it over cell phone. Hope everybody was able to hear it okay. But I just want to leave with a final note that I have
sure.
a website, popeannalisa.com. That's P-O-P-E-A-N-N-L-I-S-A, one word, popeannalisa.com. And if you go to that website, there's a lot of information and videos on there. Also tells you, you know, that you can get the book in various bookstores, or at least if you don't find it on the shelves, you can order it through most major bookstores now. So I hope some people are able to check it out and read it, and I think it'll be a good summer read for them.
Definitely, most definitely. Thanks a lot, Peter. Have a safe trip.
Thank you for having me, Bob.